Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us, a podcast on money, investing, the economy, and why they matter. I'm your host, David Stein. Today is episode 7. It's titled Predicting the Economy and the Investment Markets. Can it be done? I bring it up because last episode, episode 6, we talked about the economy and what it is and the growth of the economy, how it's measured. But there was a statistic I shared at the very end. In your typical recession, and a recession is when the economy contracts for 2 or 3 quarters in a row, the stock market falls over 30% on average. I raised the question, is it possible for an investor to anticipate what is going on with the economy and then adjust their portfolio to avoid those losses? So that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about predicting the future. Every investor, as they look out, they look at this impenetrable wall that often seems impenetrable. It's the future. What's going to happen? What individual securities should I buy anticipating what's going to happen in terms of earnings, in terms of development of those companies, in terms of buying an asset class? What do I think investment returns are going to be for bonds or for stocks? The future is always out there. And it's really easy to look back at trends and say, well, this is what happened, but here's what's going to happen in the future, at least to anticipate. But can one successfully invest based on that and get the answer right? That's what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to start with an article that was written in the year 1900. It was written in the Ladies' Home Journal. I don't know if that magazine exists, but the author was John Alfred Watkins. Think back, the year 1900, that we just turned over the clock to a new century, and there was a lot of excitement because there was a lot of inventions coming along. So he wrote an article titled, What May Happen in the Next 100 Years? And it was an article about predictions and what he thought would happen. Some of the things that he suggested were strawberries would be as big as apples and peas as large as beets. If you think about GMO or genetically modified crops, we're not quite there, but there have been some developments, but we're certainly not eating strawberries as big as apples. He thought mosquitoes and roaches would be exterminated. He thought that we would send packages through pneumatic tubes, so little vacuum tubes like they used to have, at least in my library when I was growing up, they would send messages that way. Or in some of the old office buildings, they would send them in pneumatic tubes. And they thought, well, we'd have this network of pneumatic tubes all around the country. But there was one prediction specifically that I want to talk about. He predicted that the horse would become nearly extinct. And the reason why that's interesting is it illustrates one of the fallacies or difficulties in predicting the future. And that is we tend to view the future through the lens of the present. In other words, what's going on now, we tend to extrapolate that. So think about the year 1900s. The car was, I think, just barely invented or just certainly was not commonplace by any means. So the primary means of transportation was the bicycle. But within cities, it was the horse. That was the means of transportation. Now, there were thousands of horses in major cities. I read one article about New York City and the horses. And you think, well, what do you have with horses? Well, you have horse manure. And it would be piled up high all over the city. And it would attract flies, and it would disease, and it would smell, and it was awful. And there's all these horses, all this manure piled all over. If you're writing an article thinking, gosh, and you start to see a car, and your thought is, why would anyone want a horse? And the prediction was, well, horses are dirty. There's too many of them, and they'll become nearly extinct because we'll have other means of transportation. Now, in fact, in the 1900, there was a great exposition in France with, I think it was equivalent to the World Fair. There they did some prints, and they showed one of the prints was of a horse, and it said the title was, in the year 2000, A Curiosity. In other words, horses would be some rare. It was a picture of some kids looking around, looking at this horse, kind of at a museum almost, because it was so rare. That indicates one of the challenges in predicting the future, because we tend to extrapolate what is going on and just sort of to into the future. And that's kind of how it's often done. Now, Nicholas Nassim Taleb he wrote the book Anti-Fragile, he wrote The Black Swan, and he surmised one of the best ways to predict, we're going to predict something, it's much easier to predict what's not going to change than it is to predict what we think will change in the future. For example, he gave the example of a fork. The fork has been around for 100 years. If we were going to bet on what the fork's going to do over the next 100 years, since it's been around so long, it's more likely that that will still be there. Now, why is that important? Well, one of the things that, in terms of how I invest and many others invest, when you think, well, what's not going to change? Certainly, there's going to be economic cycles. That's not going to change. That's always going to be there. What's not going to change is human nature, the level of fear and greed in the marketplace, and how that fear and greed certainly works to the psychology of investors, but also impacts valuations. You can have bubbles and you have busts. That's not going to change. That's part of our human nature. And since markets are made up of humans, that's something that's always going to be there. So if there are going to be periods where there are booms, where the stock market is booming or a bull market, or a bear market where the stock market's contracting, periods when the economy is booming and growing very strongly, so corporate profits are growing, or periods of recession where the economy is contracting. As an investor, you have three choices in terms of what to do about that, in terms of how you view the world and structure the portfolio. And every single professional investor has to ask the same question in terms of what they're going to do. There are three ways to invest. One is to completely ignore the future and just be a buy and hold investor, where you structure your portfolio, you ride the booms up and you ride the booms down or the bus down. And I liken it to riding a roller coaster. You hang on for dear life and not even worry about what's going to happen. You just assume, sort of back to the example of Nicholas Nassim Taleb that I gave, is focus on what's not going to change. And many investors invest assuming over the long term, the stock market has increased, it's delivered a positive return. I firmly believe that because it has done so for over 100 years, that it will continue. And so I will ride out every single storm. That's one way to invest. Second way is to actually, I talk about this impenetrable wall of the future, is to actually reach out and make specific predictions of where you think the economy will be in a year, where you think the stock market will be, what companies will do very well. In other words, you're very, very entrenched in predicting specific events, specific outcomes, predicting the future. That's another way of going about it. The third way is how I invest, and I call it effectively investing on the leading edge of the present. In other words, react as things happen. In other words, knowing the economy, when the economy contracts for several periods in a row, that corporate earnings fall off dramatically, that the stock market falls, then 30% on average, instead of trying to forecast, here's what the economy is going to be a year from now or 6 months from now, react as it happens. And not completely get out of the market, but adjust portfolio risk based on the level of risk in the market. So when market valuations are high, I have less exposure to stocks. When market valuations are cheap, I will have more. When the economy is slowing down, and I'll share in a few minutes how you can tell whether the economy is likely to slow. I'll adjust my portfolio exposure. Now, that's different than predicting what the economy is going to do, because there's something in behavioral finance called confirmation bias. I follow someone on Twitter, and I like to follow him because he's a smart investor, but he is also absolutely convinced we are in a recession. And so his entire lens for viewing the future is based on viewing the present as the data comes, because he is so convinced that we are in a recession, that every single piece of data, if it's positive data saying the economy is growing, there's always an excuse why it was positive. And if it's a negative data, it confirms his view of the world. Now, that's one way to invest. I would not highly recommend that at all, because it's risky. And as opposed to, there is something investors can look at to determine the direction of the economy and adjust their portfolio exposure. There is something that's released every month across the globe. They're called Purchasers Managers Indices, or PMIs. And the global organization that puts these together is Markit, M-A-R-K-I-T. There's also one in the U.S., the Institute of Supply Management. And what they are surveys. They're comprehensive surveys where they interview manufacturers about what they're seeing in their specific marketplace in terms of trends, in terms of employment trends, in terms of inventory, in terms of demand. This is a really interesting survey, and it was just released in the U.S., where across the globe, it's released at the beginning of the month. And so you kind of get this, you get this survey once a month, very comprehensive, across the globe. But what's fascinating about it is these surveys are scaled. So generally, the common sort of the consensus is, and the providers of these surveys say, all right, if the number for the particular PMI that month is 50 or higher, so I think the most recent in the U.S., for the PMI number was, I think it was 55 or 56. And so that would suggest the economy is continuing to grow. And if it's below 50, it's commonly believed that the economy is slowing. What's interesting, though, is the number is not really 50. If you look at the data in the past, and I've gone back to to the 1950s, generally speaking, there have been seven recessions. Actually, if you go back to 1970, so that's what, 30, almost 40 years. Since 1970, we've had seven recessions. Every single one of those recessions, the PMI number, the survey data went below 48. So the number's not 50, it's 48. There have been no false alarms. There's not been an example where the PMI fell below 48, kind of in the 47 or below range, and we have not gone into recession. We was close in 1987 when the stock market crashed. It seemed like the economy was slowing. But that's a very consistent survey. Now, I mentioned this guy I follow on Twitter, and that the PMI number came out at 56. He's firmly believed we're in a recession. His thing is, well, the markets don't react. It's just survey data. It's meaningless. But it's been so consistent in terms of its ability to predict recessions. Now, there's all kinds of data to determine whether we're in a recession or not. And even this particular PMI data isn't foolproof. I mean, I like I said, I would not move completely out of the market based on that data. On the other hand, I would reduce my risk and reduce my exposure to stocks. Not everybody wants to do that. Some investors, just like I said, buy and hold, ride the market up, ride the market down. It certainly is easier that way, in the sense that the implementation is easier. I'm not so sure psychologically it's easier. If think about how you felt in 2008 if you were a buy and hold investor. Again, you couldn't predict whether the market would ever snap back. It has, fortunately. But at the time, portfolios were down 30, 40%.
Let me pause here to share some words from this week's sponsors.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. With everything seeming to get more expensive these days, you need to find proven ways to cut cost and boost performance at the same time. And NetSuite can help with that. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/David. That's netsuite.com/David. netsuite.com/David. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. In my professional life, I've seen how important it is to have quality candidates to interview so we could find the right hire. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Post your job for free at LinkedIn.com/David. That's LinkedIn.com/David to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
So when it comes to predicting the economy, the question is, can it be done? And am I able to look out 6 months and say, we are going to be in a recession? And I don't think it can be done. I look at just in September, for example, the central bank in the U.S., the Federal Reserve, released their minutes from 2008. 2008, we were already in a recession. The PMI data reflected that. It was below 50. But the Federal Reserve chairman and the board of the members of the Federal Reserve were having their bi-monthly meeting, they're having a meeting. And they were discussing what was going on in the economy. And even some of the smartest economists in the world weren't convinced. They weren't sure what to do, but they weren't actually convinced whether we were in a recession or not. And it turns out we were in one of the deepest recessions in the last 100 years since the Great Depression. So there's a difference between saying we're in a recession or we're predicting recession is going to happen, and what I'm suggesting is just look at that simple measure of PMI. It's released monthly. It's simple. It's straightforward. But it's based on reams of survey data. But it's one number. And as I said, I adjust my portfolio based on that number. And if it's not showing a recession, then I will adjust my risk accordingly. In terms of the stock market, again, can investors predict what's going to happen? Will the market go up? Will the market go down? Which companies? I don't think it could be done successfully. And I don't think it's worth paying a manager to predict the future, because I used to research money managers. I've visited hundreds of managers over the years, some of the best in the business. The best managers I know are not sitting there trying to predict the future. They're doing exactly what I do. They are reacting as the future unfolds. They are essentially investing on the leading edge of the present, and they're relying on things that don't change. What doesn't change when it comes to investing? human nature, the level of fear and greed in the market, the ability of investors to bid up valuations very high, and the ability of investors to get fearful to valuations cheap. And so some of the most smartest investors I know just adjust based on, they'll buy things that are extremely undervalued where investors are fearful, and they'll just wait it out. So they're really, in my mind, the two viable ways to invest is to either buy and hold and recognize you're in for the long term, you're willing to ride that roller coaster up and down, or you can adjust your portfolio asset mix. You can risk manage based on what's happening now, based on valuations in the market, based on the where the economy is going as reflected in this PMI data. Is it above 48 or is it below 48? And that's specifically related to the U.S., although there's global indices that are very similar that you can adjust. And then certainly there's some adjustments that could be made just based on the level of fear and greed. When investors are extremely fearful, that's an attractive time to invest. Where are we today in terms of the stock market? Well, in terms of valuation, we're on the high side. And you could look at a multiple measure. Profit margins are at all-time high. Profits are very, very high. And the market valuations are certainly above average. That's a risk. In my portfolio, I've adjusted. I've reduced my stock exposure because of that risk. Where are we in terms of the economy? The economy it continues to grow. The most recent PMI data suggests that we are not showing a slowing economy. And because of that, I'll have a little more risk based on it. It's like having different levels. Or an analogy I've used is like a traffic light. In my mind, the stock market valuations right now, it's a red light. It means slow down, be cautious. Whereas the economy is green in terms of going. So that says go. And so you can kind of adjust these two levers based on, or your level of stock exposure based on the valuations, based on economic direction. And I also look at the level of fear and greed in the market, which is called sentiment. Now you might be saying, David, the economy actually contracted in the U.S. in the first quarter. Are we not? Is that not the beginning of a recession? Well, I can tell you the PMI data does not suggest that it is. We are not below 48. So if, in fact, we are in a recession, as my Twitter friend is convinced that we are, it would be the first time that I'm aware, as I look back at this data to the 1970s, that we've ever had a recession where the PMI data didn't reflect it. Now, perhaps if we actually are, then as the survey comes out in July or the beginning of August, it will reflect that. And then I'll adjust my portfolio accordingly. There is one other prediction, 100-year prediction, that I wanted to share today. And I don't know if we're going to actually be able to get to the ramifications of this. But back in the midst of the Great Depression, the famed economist John Maynard Keynes published a talk, and he gave a talk, and then it came afterwards in a book. And he felt that one of the reasons that there was a recession or the Great Depression, one of the reasons for the Great Depression was, and let me quote, he said, "Our discovery of means of economizing the use of labor is outrunning the pace at which we can find uses for labor." In other words, because of technology, because of increased productivity, he felt that the economy, the companies and business had become so productive, they could make everything that the world needed with less and less workers. And so those workers were having less income to buy the stuff. And so it was kind of this downward spiral that we talked about in the last episode, episode 6. So, because we talked about, okay, the economy grows over the long term as population increases, the number of workers, and those workers become more efficient. And he raised the question, well, what if they're so efficient that they can make everything we need without so many workers. And his prediction was that we would continue to get so much more productive as a society that the day would come within 100 years that every worker would be able to work only 3 to 4 hours a day. They would be able to live just like Henry David Thoreau lived, as I talked about in episode 5, The True Cost of a Thing. He only worked 4 hours a day, so he could free up his days for poetry and exploring nature. Keynes looked out 100 years in the year 1930 and said we would get so efficient at making stuff that everyone would be able to work less than 4 hours. The irony is he was partly correct. He projected out what income would be, household income, as we continue to go up this upward slope. We've actually reached that number. What he missed was the fact that our needs, not even our needs, our wants would dramatically increase. Our income has gone up, but we've come up with more and more things to buy. And again, that's one of the challenges of predicting the future, because we extrapolate a trend that's happening today into the present, and we assume that will continue. But not only will it continue, but it will have dramatic ramifications, which can often be wrong. And in his case, it was wrong. One of the more interesting questions, in some ways, we're at the exact same point. We're becoming very efficient again with the use of factory technology, with robots. And again, will we be to the point where we can make things so efficiently that we have an excess of workers? That's one of the outstanding questions out there. The other question that we won't have time, and I'll discuss in a future podcast, is what would it take if we all decided to work only 4 hours? Could our economy actually succeed? What would be the impact on the stock market if we did that? We became so efficient, but we work less. I'll go ahead and next episode 8, we'll talk about that, because I've given it a lot of thought, and how would that actually work? But today's episode was the ability to predict the future. At the end, I don't think it could be done. I think it's more effective to either be a buy and hold investor and ride the roller coaster up and down. I can't do it personally, and I'm just not wired that way. I am much more comfortable adjusting my portfolio based on what's happening now, living and investing on the leading edge of the present, and doing risk control that way. So that is episode 7. You can get show notes at moneyfortherestofus.net. That's moneyfortherestofus.net. Again, you can also sign up for the Insider's Guide there, where you will get show notes sent to you and other things that I didn't cover in the podcast and other insights that I just didn't get recorded. And you get a preview of what's going to happen. So I send that out before the podcast hits Apple iTunes or Stitcher, or you can get it directly from the website, moneyfortherestofus.net. If you have any questions, you can email me at jd@jdavidstein.com or suggestions for future topics. Again, what I've shared today is for education only. I have not considered your specific risk profile. I've not given predictions for the future because I don't do that. And that's something to keep in mind, that this is just for general education. So you can learn and you continue to build on your growth. Again, thanks for being here. I'd love it if you'd be willing to leave a review of the podcast on iTunes. You can find it just Money for the Rest of Us. Thanks again.